Casino. Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Hey there, horror lovers from all across the U.S. of A. and beyond. This is Eric Peabody, your host of the Horror Hill podcast. First off, let me give you a big thank you from the bottom of our cold, haunted hearts for sticking with us through thick and thin over the last decade. You've been the lifeblood of chilling entertainment, helping us conjure up the spine-tingling stories and nightmarish content you crave. But now, we're standing at a bit of a crossroads, and we need a hand from our beloved community. Our fearless leader, Craig Groshek, has been navigating some seriously rough waters these past few years. Financial burdens, including mounting costs and declining advertising revenue across the industry, have made it difficult to keep the gears turning without a little extra help from our friends. Craig's been giving it his all, fighting to keep both the Chilling Entertainment family, our incredible writers, voice actors, sound designers, and all the ghouls behind the scenes, safe and sound. But folks, the reality is we're running low on resources, and we need your help to keep the darkness alive. We're kicking off a GoFundMe campaign with a goal of raising $10,000. It's what we need right now to keep the ship afloat. This money will go directly to our most pressing needs, like paying off debts and making sure our talented team gets the fair wages they deserve. Listeners, without your support, we're facing a real horror story. Cutting pay, losing key players, and, heaven forbid, seeing some of our favorite shows take a dirt nap, maybe for good. But with your help, we can flip the script and keep Chilling Entertainment not just alive, but thriving like a vampire at a blood bank. You can help us out right now by heading to www.helpchilling.org. That's HELPCHILLING.ORG to donate today. There are other ways to help too, such as spreading the word like wildfire on social media. Tell every horror fiend you know about our campaign and help us bring more eyes and ears to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and our other bone-chilling programs. But right now, the best thing you can do is chip in whatever you can. Every single dollar helps, and every share spreads the fear. I mean, the word. Let's keep Chilling Entertainment turning out the darkness for years to come. So please, donate today. We've got a lot more scares to share, and we'd hate to miss out on bringing you the thrills you crave. Again, you can head to www.helpchilling.org today to help out. Thank you again for your support.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Specifically, tonight's story includes a mention of suicide. Listener discretion is advised. Hello there, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. I'm Eric Peabody, your host, narrator, and author. That's right, my friends. Tonight's entertainment has been penned by yours truly. Trust me, I'm as surprised as you are. I dabble in writing horror fiction from time to time, but with this episode requiring something rock and roll themed, following our sex and drug stories of the last 2 weeks, I figured it was time to put down my microphone for a bit and pick up a pencil. The title of this tale is Cadenza. Phil, Steve, Andy, and Jim are in a metal band on tour. Things have largely been going fine for them, with one small hitch. Andy, their guitarist, has a bad habit of wandering away after shows, frequently causing frustrations and delays for the rest of the guys. This is far from a rare occurrence, but things are a bit different this time. Not only has Andy been gone far longer than usual, but he seems to be a little different when he reunites with his bandmates, more spacey and strangely excited. What his friends don't know is that Andy has had an epiphany, and the repercussions will be far vaster than they could have imagined. You're listening to the standard edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, and we can scale back some of our less savory means of generating money for the show. By the way, you wouldn't happen to still have all of your organs, would you? And now, from author Eric Peabody, I give you Cadenza. It was time to leave Providence, and no one knew where the fuck Andy was. The rest of us, Steve, Jim, and I, sat in a booth at the IHOP, breakfast long finished, along with our patients. Not just ours, either. The last time the waitress had swung by, her need a warm-up offer was noticeably icier than during the earlier 5 visits. Luckily, Jim had just come back up from a light doze, or she probably would have kicked us out. Steve was in a cycle of picking up his phone, seeing no new messages, tossing it back onto the table in disgust, and then inevitably picking it up again 2 minutes later. I was sipping my coffee, looking out the window for any sign of Andy while keeping half an eye on the van and trailer. The morning sun was bright and shrill, but gave a sort of unexpected beauty to the trash-littered parking lot. It glittered cleanly off the remaining clumps of snow melting along the back fence, the broken bottles, the occasional discarded rubber. It was 9:07 a.m. We had to be in Pittsburgh by 6 that night for load-in and soundcheck, which was already cutting it close, but it wouldn't matter if we didn't have our fucking guitarist. No one had seen him since the show the previous night. This wasn't out of the ordinary for Andy, though he was pushing it more than usual this time. But in general, I considered myself lucky as far as bandmates go. The 4 of us had known each other since college, and outside of the expected minor spats that result from being in a touring metal band, we were generally on the same page. Jim had put it rather succinctly one day when he said, "How many people get to actually do this shit, man? Why fuck it up?" And we did our best to not fuck it up. We got to shows on time, kept up on practice, and besides some weed and beer after getting off stage, stayed away from partying too hard. Being in that middle tier of bands that could pull in decent numbers on a regional tour but still needed to hold down day jobs back home, we knew that the next couple of years were either going to tip us over into doing this full time, or we'd start losing ground and have to return to normal life. We loved doing this, so yeah, why fuck it up? Unfortunately, Andy interpreted the concept of being a responsible musician in a more bohemian sense than the rest of us. All of us were artists, at least by some metric, but Andy was the artist. He was the one focused on the more esoteric side of music, the one always bringing in new albums by random bands for us to listen to, the one reading poetry while screwed up into some shrimp shape on the back seat in the van, the one always wandering off in each new city to sample the vibe, as he put it. Though he didn't talk about his past much, I knew that he was an only child and his parents had been pretty closed off. I wondered if that was what led to his intense need to connect with people and places. As the primary songwriter, this actually worked well, in some respects. Andy could take any old Iommi derivative riff and find ways to make it fresh and interesting, sometimes even mystifying. He always knew just where a song should ramp up or ease off, how to guide the audience's ear to each segment for maximum impact. "You gotta work with the notes that you don't hear," he said to me once, and even though I'd be hard-pressed to describe what that meant in any tangible way, I knew it when I heard it. Andy's songwriting carried the unseen weight of the limitless behind it, and in a world of guttural growls and endless blast beats, he could crush you with a single note. And really, that was the way Andy communicated, through music. As soon as he found a better way, he told us during practice one day, he'd switch to that. He laughed as he said it, and so did we. Andy was such a damn good guitarist that I couldn't see him ever switching to some other form of artistic expression. But good fucking God, the guy was such a flake sometimes. Andy's dedication to siphoning any and all artistic inspiration out of something made him tough to pin down. 2 years ago, down in Asheville, he vanished while we were breaking down our gear and loading it back into the van. He at least had the courtesy to carry out his gear first, but after that, none of us could find him. This wasn't terribly unexpected, so the rest of us finished the loadout and then waited, figuring he'd turn up. 11 at night slowly plodded to 2 in the morning, at which point the three of us, tired and sore, gave up and went with our long-established band protocol. Whenever Andy went AWOL, we drove to wherever the nearest IHOP was, and we waited. Inevitably, we'd eventually see Andy walking up to our table, seemingly from out of nowhere, lanky blonde hair hanging down past his thin shoulders, a smile on his face, and a waiting story behind his lips. He would give us some yarn about a fan that had wanted to show him their collection of old jazz records, or a girl that caught his attention talking about the haunted part of the city a few miles away, or a group of musicians that enticed him into a late-night jam session at someone's house. It would have been easy as pie for Andy to drop us a quick, "Hey, heading out for a bit, be back soon," text so the rest of us knew what was up. But that wasn't how Andy did things, and we had stopped asking long ago. The IHOP plan always worked pretty well. Sure, we'd lose some sleep or maybe hit the road a bit later than usual, but we tried to take it in stride. The dude wasn't off hooking up with teenagers or shooting heroin. It could be a lot worse. Besides, Andy's free love relationship with his muse seemed to actually work for him, and it showed in the music he wrote. We all knew that Andy's songwriting was what elevated us from being a damn good local band to the type of act that might have a shot at turning this into a career. The sound of Steve's phone hitting the table pulled me back from my thoughts. "Jesus Christ," he grunted, sinking his bearded bulk lower into the booth. I checked my watch. 9:25. Jim yawned and stretched, his ratty revocation shirt pulling up and turning the already crazed The Outer Ones logo into complete visual noise. He rubbed his hand briskly over his bald head to perk himself up. This was, by far, the longest Andy had ever kept us waiting, and none of us had gotten much sleep, taking turns dozing in the freezing van while the other two would stay in the diner. "Hey, Philly," Jim said, sipping his cup of coffee, finding it cold, and grimacing. "We all good on gas and stuff?" "Yep," I replied. We had gotten into town a little early yesterday, and I'd had a chance to gas up and check the tires before we started setting up for the show. I tried to do what I could to keep things running smoothly. After all, why fuck it up, right? Jim had been with me during this, but I knew where he was coming from. There's a particular feeling of helplessness that results from someone holding up a group trip, and you needed to feel like you had at least some control over the situation.
"Why don't we just get going then?"
Steve asked. He was staring right at me, as if this was somehow my fault or my decision. His eyes, red and tired, loomed behind all of that dark hair and beard.
"Dude,"
I replied, trying to keep the exasperation out of my voice.
"He'll show up. He always does. Besides, what's the plan for the show if we don't have a guitarist?"
"We'll just use the backing track. It's more reliable, anyway."
He glowered, unblinking, and crossed his arms. I saw Jim make a face. We had backing tracks with everyone's parts pre-recorded. We hardly ever used them, as they were mainly a backup plan for a worst-case scenario, like if I broke my wrist and couldn't play bass, or if an amp blew last minute and no one had anything we could borrow. Thinking back, there were only 3 times we'd had to go Milli Vanilli style for part of a show, and it was a headache each time. We were used to playing organically, just the 4 of us, and using the backing tracks required some extra considerations, worst of all, making Jim drum to a metronome. The dude was old school, and while he kept incredible time on his own, he had a natural push and pull to his tempo that didn't play too well with a click track. I frowned. "Those Pittsburgh crowds are ravenously blue-collar, man. You really think they're gonna dig watching a 3-piece with all the guitars coming out of the PA? They'll fucking eat us alive."
"It's a 9-hour drive, Phil. That's without stopping for food or to take a shit or anything. We're already way behind. You want to miss the show?"
"Why is this my fault all of a sudden?"
The irritation in my voice was starting to show. We were all worn out, and with Steve deciding to focus his frustration on me, it was hard not to do the same to him. He mellowed a bit.
"It's not," he sighed. "But we're out of time. We can't keep sitting here, and I'm tired of this being a regular thing. Maybe it's time we started talking about other options."
Jim sat up.
"What do you mean?"
Steve glanced at him briefly, but directed his speech to me.
"Maybe we need someone a bit more responsible."
I frowned.
"Dude, are you being serious? Yeah, he can flake out a bit sometimes, but he's never totally bailed on us. And besides, he writes the music. You want to try to replace the primary songwriter?"
"He's not the only person to ever write a song, man."
"Oh, come on. None of the shit we write is worth anything until Andy has a chance to rework it. You know that. I haven't met one other person in the world that writes music like him."
"Bands replace members all the time," Steve replied stonily.
"Are we really having this conversation on no sleep in a fucking IHOP?"
My voice was starting to raise.
"Well, we have the time, don't we? I'd rather be on the road right now, but our fucking guitarist is missing."
He had started leaning over the table a bit, and I absentmindedly noticed that his hair was getting dangerously close to falling into the remaining syrup on his plate.
"Hey," Jim said mildly,
"how about we deal with one problem at a time instead of making this a big fucking issue?"
I replied.
"Oh, come on. We can't do anything right now. He's not here, man. What do you want to do? Go driving around fucking Providence, dragging a trailer full of gear, looking for him? Look, this has been a problem for all of us for way too long now. Someone has to step up and make the hard decisions, and..."
"Don't start that lead singer ego bullshit, man."
"Hey,"
Jim said again.
"Lead singer bullshit? What about you, Phil? Maybe you should actually put some effort into your writing so we don't have to rely on Andy so much."
"That's not fucking fair, and you know it. Anyone can write the shit that I write, but Andy..."
"It doesn't matter, since he's never fucking around!"
Steve was almost yelling now. There was an elderly couple a few tables over who had been giving the scary metalheads disapproving looks all morning, and I now saw the man stand up and start walking toward the hostess.
Shit.
"Look,"
I said, forcing some control into my voice and consciously relaxing my posture. "We've been doing this for 10 years, and he's never let us down. If we need to talk about this, sure, but let's wait until we finish the rest of the tour and get home."
"There's not gonna be a rest of the tour if we keep sitting here in this fucking..."
"Hey!"
Jim shouted. We both stopped and turned to him.
He was looking at us with mild irritation, but when he saw that he finally had our attention, he gestured his head toward the window. I looked out at the van. Someone was lying on their back on top of the trailer, arms spread, soaking up the sun in the chilly morning. It was Andy.
John Daly here. You know what day it is?
Neither do I.
I live life daily. That's why I only spin on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily. And the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto. America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
The van sped west on I-80. Jim was at the wheel, music blasting on the stereo. It had started at a reasonable volume, but Jim had slowly turned it up as the rest of us argued, and it finally had the intended effect of shutting us up. Steve was hunched in the front passenger seat, frowning out the window. He hadn't said anything in a while. I was sitting in back next to Andy, and even over the pounding music, I could still hear his pencil on the notepad scratching away. I didn't look over at him, and I didn't try to talk to him. The music was too loud, I was too fucking tired, and Andy was being too weird. We were still 3 hours out from Pittsburgh, and I'd need all of that time to get my mood back under control. I had hastily paid our bill as the three of us hurried out of the IHOP, earning one more glare from the old-timers at the nearby table. We were only about halfway across the parking lot when Steve, deciding to open diplomatically, called out, "What the actual fuck, man?" As he did, he slipped a bit in the melting snow, causing his voice to hitch, and I knew that was a small embarrassment that he'd have to overcompensate for. I stopped and sighed. Andy sat up, and I could see that he was shirtless, steam rising from his body. He looked like he'd just gotten out of the shower. He smiled down at us from the top of the trailer, dishwater hair hanging across his relaxed shoulders. He didn't say anything right away, but he appeared to be incredibly awake for someone that had ostensibly been up all night. As I got closer, I realized it was more than that, actually. He looked energized, not in a buzzy way, but like someone that had just gotten the best pep talk in the world from their biggest hero, and maybe a hit of some seriously good weed as well. "Holy shit, guys," he said. There was some quality in his voice I couldn't quite identify. It was partly excitement, sure, but there was something else. "You won't believe what happened." "Where the fuck have you been, Andy?" Steve shouted. He was now at the side of the trailer, and something about him standing there, looking up to the shirtless figure on top, who was in turn looking down, steam rising from his body, the sun illuminating him, it tickled my brain. The rugged barbarian gazing up at the slender Greek god. It was like looking at a Renaissance painting. "It happened, Steve," Andy said. He was apparently unperturbed by Steve's outburst. "It finally happened, and I finally get it," he continued to smile. "Dude, come down. We really need to get moving," said Jim, walking past Steve and unlocking the driver's door. "Jim, good. I want to talk to you about the drum patterns for the show tonight. I've got some ideas." "What the fuck are you talking about?" Steve seemed ready to blow up for real. "You've been gone all night. We couldn't reach you, and we're going to be late for Pittsburgh. Get off the fucking trailer and let's go!" Andy turned his head back to Steve, slowly, that elated grin still on his face. "Everything's fine, man," he said. He looked up towards the sun. "Better than fine." Steve opened his mouth to say something else, but I had caught up by that point, and I put a hand on his shoulder. He spun around, and for a moment, I thought he might try to hit me. Then his eyes cleared a bit, his tense posture relaxed, and he shrugged my hand off. "Let's just fucking go," he muttered, sulking off towards the passenger door. Jim started the engine, a blast of exhaust spitting out of the back and rising up between the van and the trailer. It clouded the sunlight illuminating Andy, transforming it into an eerie glow. For a second, I just stood there in the cold. The crisp smell of the morning was losing its battle with the reek of the van's exhaust, and I wanted to get inside where it was warmer, but still, I stayed where I was. Andy was acting weird, even for him, and I suddenly noticed that although he was shirtless on that late winter morning, I couldn't see any goosebumps on his body. I felt my own rise a bit in response. "Andy," I started, a trace of concern in my voice. Yes, the dude was usually a bit strange, but I cared about him. We all did. Even with Steve's mini tirade and all, we were a team, a group, a band. Harmony was important to us, if you'll pardon the pun, and something was pinging my radar. "What's going on, dude?" He turned from the sun and beamed down at me. "Everything, man," he said. "Everything." And I finally realized what it was that I was hearing in his voice. It wasn't excitement. It was reverence. The first leg of the drive west had been a nightmare. As soon as we got rolling, Andy brought up the drum patterns topic again, but he didn't get far. Steve asked why he wanted to switch things up last minute, but I could tell that he didn't really want an answer. The question was just a springboard for him to launch into his own grievances with Andy. Where had he been? What had he been doing? Why the fuck didn't he text any of us? Andy remained serene throughout the ensuing exchange, which did nothing but rile Steve up more. The conversation quickly deteriorated, with Steve yelling, Andy responding with confusing half-answers, and me occasionally trying to step in to mediate. I wasn't happy to find myself in that position, since I had my own irritations that I wanted to address. In spite of his short fuse, Steve was right. Andy had fucked up. We all wanted this behavior to stop, and I had hoped to discuss it with Andy in a way that might actually result in some positive change. Now, having to play devil's advocate in the face of Steve's mounting anger, all I was doing was making him more upset while simultaneously undermining any basis I had for my own argument. Through it all, Jim was slowly turning up the volume on the stereo. At that point, the album was Morbid Angel's Gateways to Annihilation, and by the time the opening note of He Who Sleeps hit, it sounded like a bomb going off. Even with all of the shouting and noise and Andy's weirdness, we managed to find out what his story was. At least, most of it. He had been with some musician, a cellist, I think. Andy had noticed her at the show, apparently eye-fucking him the whole time he was on stage. As he was breaking down his rig, she came up to him and started chatting about music. This led to him going back to her place, where they did something. Here was where it got a little fuzzy. Andy said that they vibed, and that she slowly began to reveal something to him. He wasn't being cagey with us, per se, but I got the impression he wasn't being totally forthcoming either. I assumed he meant that they got blasted and screwed, and while I didn't voice this outright, Andy seemed to know. He looked right at me as I thought that and said, "It was so much more powerful than sex, more powerful than anything." That same satisfied, unreadable smile was still on his face, and I found myself wondering if maybe he'd finally slipped into something serious, a heavy psychedelic maybe. "So powerful you couldn't pick up your fucking phone and let your bandmates know where you were?" shouted Steve from the front. Before he got an answer, he slammed his hand on the dash. I saw Jim reach over and turn up the volume a bit. "Steve, I can't begin to describe to you how important this is for me, for all of us," Andy began, but that was all he got out before Steve turned around and started in again. The remaining portion of the conversation was nothing more than Steve spewing bile with Andy sitting there, peacefully taking it. There was something about the look on his face that reminded me of a parent listening to a child throw a tantrum. Patient, caring, and a little pitying, as if he knew there was some fundamental flaw in Steve's understanding. Now, with any chance of immediate reconciliation well and truly fucked, I resigned myself to waiting out the rest of the drive and the simmering tension filling the van. The music blared, the road unfurled before us, and I absently listened to the scratching of Andy's pencil. I was tired and might have been dozing a bit, but I began to notice a sort of rhythm to it, a rising and falling in an odd meter, like waves swelling up on the shore and then viscously sliding back, always starting up again before expected, no matter how much you thought you were wrapping your head around it. This was, of course, absurd. No one writing anything coherent could maintain a mechanical rhythm with a pencil over any length of time, and the fact that the rhythm itself seemed to be off-kilter, maybe a 7-count with an occasional dropped 16th note at the end? Or was it a series of 9 repeating beats that added an extra one every so often? Well, that just showed how much my own fatigue and distraction were adding to the effect. Boredom and frustration were getting the better of me, and my mind was trying to find something structured to focus on as a counterbalance to the chaos of the morning. I glanced over at Andy's notepad, expecting to see lyrics or chord charts or maybe a guitar tab. The angle made it hard for me to make out exactly what he was writing, but it was obviously none of those things. It looked like some sort of cursive, which was odd because Andy never wrote in cursive. The text swirled and flowed across the page, seemingly without any breaks, and for the briefest moment, my perspective refocused, and I thought I glimpsed some geometric shape, something emerging from the continuous, sinewing lines of graphite, like a magic eye image that suddenly clicks into impromptu clarity. The rhythmic rasp of his pencil grew more pronounced, and even with the overpowering wall of sound blasting out of the stereo speakers, I started to hear something else. Some undercurrent or counterpoint. Something that wasn't necessarily working in conjunction with the rhythm of the pencil, but responding to it. An almost gibbous pulse, more felt than heard, that seemed to be answering that tidal slithering. But maybe I had it wrong. And this new element was actually the one initiating, and Andy's pencil was, in turn, replying, or transcribing. The van hit a pothole, jostling me, and the effect was gone in an instant. I shifted in my seat, shaking off a slight chill. The van wasn't the newest, and it didn't surprise me that some of the winter cold was radiating from the glass window next to me. The Morbid Angel album had long since given way to other road favorites, Byzantine, Sulfur Eon, Night of the Round. I was mildly surprised to notice that we were now midway through that seminal album, Master of Puppets. Hetfield's voice tore out of the speakers like a thing possessed, ominously intoning about waking sleepers, hunters of shadows, and strange eons. I pulled my flannel overshirt up a bit to cover my neck. That chill from the window was more noticeable, and I couldn't wait to get to Pittsburgh and start setting up. With a little luck, we'd have a kick-ass show, washing away all of the day's nettles with a torrent of brutality. The miles rolled by, Andy riding, Steve fuming, Jim driving and tapping his foot to the music. I was getting sleepy, and I didn't fight it. It had been a long fucking night, and catching some sleep now was a good idea. As I drifted off, it struck me that Jim must be pretty tired as well. After all, his foot tapping seemed to be a bit off from the steady beat of the Metallica song. In fact, it almost sounded a little like the same rhythm from Andy's pencil. I had been hoping for a real banger of a show. One where setup is easy, soundcheck goes great, you and your buddies are firing on all cylinders, and the crowd is giving that energy back to you in spades. How wrong we can be sometimes. We had barely begun to unload when Andy started in on the new drum beats again. Jim expressed at least a passing interest in hearing him out, but Steve overheard and cut in.
We're not changing shit up right before a show. We wrote these songs months ago, some of them years ago. Skull Extractor's already on a fucking album, man. We play it as we always have.
This was enough to stop the conversation, but Andy seemed a little distracted as he continued to set up his rig. We were third in the stack that night, following two openers and then hitting the stage right before Wraith. We had been lucky to get onto this bill, and even though we didn't get to support them on the rest of their tour, the exposure from this one gig was appreciated. The point is that there was a lot of gear on a modestly sized stage, a lot of musicians and support staff moving around, and a lot of opportunities for something to get overlooked, or for someone to go missing. Soundcheck went fine, pretty good actually. For a small venue, more of a glorified bar really, the acoustics were surprisingly coherent. The combination of my Ampeg, Andy's Mesa, and a triggered double kick drum can sometimes turn into sonic mush, but not tonight. Steve had eaten a burger while we were setting up and seemed to be in a bit better mood now. I even caught sight of him nodding his head a bit to the beat as we were soundchecking the instruments, and when he came up to run through the vocal chain, the usual fire and vitriol in his voice was in full force. As we wrapped up and started clearing the stage for the next band to soundcheck, I was actually feeling optimistic. There were about to be a lot of folks here that were going to hear us for the first time, and it seemed like we'd make a good impression. But later, as the second opener was finishing up their set and we were getting ready to take the stage, Jim asked, "Hey, where's Andy?" The three of us looked around. We had been tucked into a little alcove behind and to the side of the stage. Steve had actually laughed in the owner's face when he called it the green room, and were somewhat out of the general hustle and bustle. I could have sworn that Andy was right there with us just a few moments earlier, his guitar slung over his shoulder and ready to rock. Now, he had vanished. "Fuck!" spat Steve. What followed was a tense 20-minute search through the packed venue. The act of searching for someone in any crowd is difficult enough, but add in the loud music, the moshing, the general drunken demeanor of the audience, and the haze from the fog machines, cigarettes, and joints, and you have an absolute clusterfuck on your hands. On top of that, one can't exactly go pushing through a crowd with an instrument strapped to themselves, so Jim volunteered to stay behind and keep an eye on my bass, along with the other equipment that we had backstage. Steve and I were the taller ones anyway. Better vantage. By the time the second opener finished clearing off the stage, we were no closer to finding Andy. We had reconvened in the green room after having checked the toilets, the floor, outside, and even in the van and trailer. The house lights were up now, but he was still nowhere to be found. The dude was simply gone. "All right, fuck it. We're using the backing tracks. Any objections?" Steve was sitting on an errant bar stool, looking at the floor, left leg bouncing anxiously. Jim shrugged, irritated resignation on his face. "Fine. Yeah, sure. I'll go grab the laptop." He left toward the front of the venue, fishing his keys out of his pocket. After he left, Steve looked up at me. "He's missing a show, man. He's actually leaving us fucking high and dry." He shook his head and chuckled a bit in disbelief. I kept my mouth shut. Nothing I could say would do anything except piss him off more. Yeah, Andy had fucked us for real this time. Hitting the road late was one thing, but vanishing before a show, and an important one at that. Jim came running up, concern on his face. "Guys, the laptop's gone." I perked up. "What?" "It's just gone. I checked everywhere, the trailer, the van, even under the seats. It's just not there, man."
Steve said, "Are the windows broken or anything?"
"No, dude, nothing's broken. Everything else is there. I even..."
A sudden loud sound caused all of us to stop and look up. It was a guitar, playing full volume from the stage. We rushed around toward the front so we could see, and there was Andy, tuning up in front of his amp. There were a number of emotions and questions running through my mind at that moment, but I shoved them all down. The four of us had to have a serious conversation when this was over, but for now, we had to do this show. "Come on," I said, grabbing both Jim and Steve by an arm and pulling them with me. "Don't think about it, don't get pissed about it. He's here, we can do the set, and we can figure out the rest of this shit later." We got our stuff and hit the stage. The first half of the set went surprisingly great. We were all well rehearsed, so even with the now you see him, now you don't bullshit Andy pulled, we quickly locked into the groove. Steve was screaming into the mic, obviously venting his frustration. Andy was playing with his usual virtuosic flair, and Jim seemed to have some extra pep and snap to his drumming. I think his near miss with the click track made him extra appreciative of getting to be up there bareback. It was after the fourth song that everything went to shit. Our set on that tour consisted of 8 songs, with a pseudo intermission halfway through. Jim and Steve and I would get a chance to take a breather, and Andy would take center stage for a prolonged guitar solo. Yeah, stuff like that can come off as self-indulgent and boring, but it never was with Andy. He would improvise it on the spot each time, and the way he built and released tension would invariably keep the crowd riveted. Frankly, it was fun for me too, since I'd usually be able to pick up little snippets of stuff he'd been talking about recently. This was one of the ways that I knew his unexpected absences paid off. I would hear those new influences being reflected in a tangible way. Everything Andy absorbed got added to this complex inner structure that served as his musical vocabulary, and he had the mind and technical chops to navigate it and use it to great effect. His fingers would fly, the audience would become spellbound, and when the rest of us slammed back in, it felt like a brand new heavy all over again. But tonight, I immediately knew that something was different. Something was wrong. As our fourth song, a bludgeoning track called Obliterator, finished up, Andy held the last note while the rest of us navigated around the power hubs and cables behind the amp stacks to stretch and have some water. I could still see Andy from where I was, and instead of immediately moving to center stage like usual, he walked over to the edge of the stage and activated a foot switch. It took me a moment before I recognized that small piece of equipment, but as soon as I did, I followed the cable with my eyes as it snaked across the stage, around another amp stack that Wraith had set up, and into a small gear crate that I hadn't noticed before. In that crate, just barely peeking out from among a mess of audio cables, was our laptop. And at the same instant that my brain logged this information, the backing tracks began playing. Or rather, a new backing track began playing. An empty howling sound started to ooze out of the PA speakers, something atonal and haunting. Though I couldn't discern a pitch, there was movement to it. It dipped and swelled, and it seemed to move around the stereo field in ways that I shouldn't have been able to notice from where I was. Andy still held that same note, plucking the string every so often to keep it going, and now he was moving to the center of the stage. I caught his face in 3/4 profile as he did, and something I saw there terrified me, deeply. It was that same exalted smile that he had earlier, when he had been staring up into the sun from the roof of the trailer, but now I could also see tears streaming down his face. His eyes looked horrified as well as rapturous, and his jaw was shuddering open and closed. I realized that he was sobbing, caught in the grip of some mixture of emotions so strong that his face seemed to be almost tearing itself apart as it tried to express it. And then he began to play. He started slowly, shifting that note down to what seemed to be the exact wrong pitch to overlay with the howling of the backing track. The disharmony was immediately apparent, but after a moment, it somehow felt perfectly right in the worst way. The howling took on a slightly new timbre, and as it oscillated through its established movement, it would occasionally resonate with the note Andy was holding, the sympathetic vibrations causing a momentary jump in volume each time it did so. This resulted in a rhythm gradually defining itself out of the shambling duet, and soon I recognized it. It was the same rhythm that I had heard from Andy's pencil as he was writing in the van. Andy started to twist the wrist of his fretting hand, introducing vibrato to the note he was generating. And though I'd heard Andy cleanly play almost every guitar technique known to man, he seemed to be fucking this up. It wasn't smooth and even like it should be. It jittered erratically, never rising to or returning to the exact same pitch. It was like finding yourself in an elevator car with an angry wasp zipping around, almost landing on you before darting somewhere else. And the whole time, the wind of the shaft that the car was passing through swirled around you like a tempest. It had a mutating effect on the rhythm with the backing track, causing it to drag and hitch, and I was again reminded of eldritch waves on some strange shore, heaving their syrupy bulk onto alien sands before reluctantly lurching back to the concealing sea. While still holding that dissonant, tremulous note, Andy began to play a counter melody with his right hand, aggressively tapping his free fingers against the fretboard, sliding up and down, never staying too long in any particular place before slipping languidly to the next. I had never heard anything that was simultaneously so frenetic and so slothen. It felt almost wet somehow, glistening like something biological and profane. An eel, slick with viscera, hunching its way up and out of a dead man's digestive tract. In an odd sort of way, it reminded me of a cello. I was looking at Andy's back as he played, and now my attention shifted to the audience facing him. I could see expressions of confusion, of repulsion. People were already starting to go over to the bar, the restrooms, anywhere that wasn't directly in the aural splash zone of this fetid onslaught. The floor started to empty, but as it did so, I realized that some people were staying. Actually, scratch that, they were moving in. It was only maybe a dozen or so of the several hundred that had been there minutes earlier, but they drifted forward as if in a dream, their eyes never leaving Andy. One of them tripped as he was approaching, clumsily falling onto his face, but instead of standing back up, he curled into a fetal position on his side, holding himself tightly. I could see him shuddering, the ridges of his vertebrae prominent under the waxen skin where his shirt had pulled up. Andy kept playing, the music pulsing through the venue like the delivery contractions of some dying beast, and I couldn't pull my eyes off that fan's spine. The haze in the room seemed to be increasing, and my vision swam in and out of focus. Bones under his skin. They connected to his whole skeleton, I thought. Isn't that odd? There's an entire architecture in there, integral and so essential, but we never really see it. Strong, too. Stronger than any other part of us. Our blood, our flesh, already rotting, even though we don't know it. Stronger even than our minds. What are the petulant dreams of our flawed biological sputtering next to the inflexible solidity of those inner buttresses? But that was also dangerous, wasn't it? Having something so resilient, so eternal, surrounded by all that fawning viscera. Look at how those ridges are pressing out against his skin. If he keeps curling tighter and tighter, straining that wretched parchment, the tips of those bones will start to push out further and further, and eventually it will be too much. A small point of white and red will blossom from that revolting carrion, and then another, and another, rupturing outward in a slowly forming line from a husk that is a desecration to its hidden purity. And then the spaces between those little nubs will split apart, sloughing to the side as this archipelago claws upward and becomes a mountain range, towering and indefinable, reaching far beyond the limitations of the unworthy putrescence that had imprisoned it. And it's really like that everywhere, with everything, isn't it? Not just the human form, fundamentally flawed and doomed to repugnance and decrepitude. No. Any structure born from that, no matter how marvelous, would pale in comparison to the oppressive, cyclopean monoliths that might be born from other things, other falsehoods that the world shows us every day. Frightened and mewling constructs that hold the seeds of greater and truer forms within their trembling shells. What is a thing born from a man next to that born from a continent, from the oceans and skies themselves, even? More, what ultimate, grandiose divinities would burst forth from the splitting of the gravitational pull that holds us to the Earth, or keeps these farcical planets circling around their charlatan sun? What will eventually arise in its omnipotent and unimaginable majesty when the leprous canopy of the whole cosmic hallucination itself is rent apart? What final truth lies chained and hidden within the structure of reality? There was a sudden jolt as something hit my face. My fixation on the man's spine cut off, but in that last moment before it did, I felt a sort of sucking. It was like my brain was disengaging itself from something wet and greedy, pulling back across a vast distance before slamming into my skull. I realized that my face hurt and that someone was yelling my name.
Phil? Phil! Dude, are you okay?
Steve and Jim were standing above me, eyes wide and scared. I noticed that Jim's nose was bleeding, though we hadn't become aware of it.
What? What's happening?
I slurred. I felt drunk.
You zoned out and fell over. Where were you? In the fucking astral plane?
Jim asked, and I shuddered at how accurate that quip felt.
John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spin on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily, and the best part, guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto, America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino, the social casino. Void where prohibited, no purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
They helped me up, and even though I felt woozy, I managed to keep my feet.
You guys, you have to stop this. Now.
My voice held none of the power that I intended. The strange music continued to swirl around us, through us.
Yeah, no shit. He's clearing the whole place out. I was about to grab him before you did your fainting act,
Steve said.
No.
I replied, my voice a bit stronger now.
That won't do it. You have to stop him right now. Unplug his amp or the laptop or something. Quick!
Steve's face showed confusion, and Jim suddenly reached up to his nose, apparently just now realizing that he was bleeding.
What the fuck are you talking about?
Steve demanded. How disgusting he looked in that moment, staring at me with his piggish eyes. Sweat-matted hair clinging to his forehead. Why was I even bothering with him? What could I expect from someone so stupid? What a waste. All of the days he had spent on this earth. All of the energy wasted to bring this insignificant wretch to this stinking hovel. And not just him. Jim, too. Standing there as his oh-so-precious blood began to flow more forcefully out of his crusted nostril. A look of increasing alarm on his face. What did it even matter? These base caricatures, these hollow incubators of true life, squeaking their inarticulate thoughts into the world with no more importance than the flatulence that expelled. I jerked my head to the side, hard, smashing my ear into the back of a speaker cabinet. My thoughts cleared a bit, and I didn't waste my chance. A red plastic cup full of water was next to me. Without hesitation, I grabbed it and poured the whole thing into the closest electrical hub. There was a flash, a burst of smoke, and the backing track cut out immediately. Andy's amp was unaffected, and he kept playing, but the otherworldly pressure hovering at the edge of my perception was gone. After a few moments, the guitar faltered, whatever enchantment Andy had been weaving, unraveling into simple, droning feedback. He spun around and stared at me. That bizarre expression on his face had changed to one of disorientation and confusion, and remorse? That was our last show together. I didn't see Andy for another 6 years. It's 3:32 in the morning as I'm finishing up this... What even is this? An accounting? A journal? A plea? The rain is coming down hard, rattling against the window by my desk. The word desk might be a bit grandiose, actually. It's a small table with a single lamp, tucked into the corner of this microscopic studio apartment. Being the only flat surface that I can sit next to, it serves as my eating area, laundry table, and writing desk. When your whole world has to fit into a 12 by 15 room, you make do. Things haven't been great since the band split up. The rest of the tour got canceled, obviously, and we ended up on the hook for a decent amount of money. That, plus the sudden and unexpected crumbling of the last decade of my life, dropped me into a bit of a funk, to put it mildly. 10 years of why fuck it up turned into a numbing, pervasive apathy. Why not fuck it up? Where had the alternative gotten me? Yeah, I started drinking more, partying more. Can you even call it partying when you're just trying to forget? To numb your memories and your senses? Stop what you're feeling and what you're hearing. I only worked as much as I needed to get by. After about a year of sulking and going through each day in a sort of resigned shuffle, I started trying out for a few other bass gigs. But news had traveled, and people knew about our weird performance in Pittsburgh. Anyone that was even open to auditioning me quickly noticed that I was out of practice, and it was probably pretty obvious that I didn't give a shit. Sure, that might have been understandable, maybe even acceptable. For a bit. But now? 6 years on? The rain still crackles against the window. It should just be white noise, but my mind will start drifting, and then I realize I've been focusing on that pattering sound instead of my writing, vigilantly monitoring its continued chaos, making sure it stays random. My impromptu dousing of the power dump at the venue was more effective than I had intended, shorting out everything on stage left and damaging some of the amps the other bands had set up. The whole show got stopped dead in its tracks, and we packed up as quickly as we could amidst belligerent audience members and a furious club owner. About half an hour later, we found ourselves, surprise, surprise, at another IHOP. By that point, all of us were too flabbergasted and exhausted to have a giant screaming match. We wanted Andy to explain what the fuck had happened, but all he wanted was to leave. "It's not important anymore," he had said. He was looking out the window into another trash-littered parking lot, the night clear, the stars bright. The rest of us just sat there around the booth, Jim lightly tapping his fingers against the rim of his coffee cup. Steve had his hands jammed into the pockets of his denim jacket, mouth downturned as he stared fixedly at an indeterminate point on the table. "Tell us what you mean, man," I said. Andy didn't turn away from the window. "The band, guitar, music, it's not important anymore. It's not working. Not what I thought it was." I sighed and ran my hands through my hair. Steve grunted, "You're not making any fucking sense." I saw a hint of a smile touch the corner of Andy's mouth. "None of it ever has," he said quietly. Suddenly, Jim jumped as if something had stung him. His hand stopped drumming on the coffee mug and he shoved it away from him fast, overturning it and spilling the lukewarm dregs across the table. He looked at his fingers for a moment in surprise and then grabbed a napkin and began to mop up the mess. Steve sat up and leaned forward, his forearms on the table. "Well, you're out, man. No more. Your bullshit's fucking things up for the rest of us." Jim and I didn't say anything. Neither did Andy. In the end, we went our separate ways. Andy didn't even drive back with us, didn't take his gear, nothing. Just called a cab and left straight from the diner. Told us to sell his shit, that he didn't care. The rest of us got back home a few days later, tired and forlorn. Steve pawned most of Andy's equipment to help pay our newly incurred debt. I kept a few things, his guitar, a couple of pedals, in the hopes that he'd someday reconnect with us. But I think that I knew, even then, that wasn't going to happen. Eventually, I hawked everything to pay for my own mounting bills. During that first month after Andy left, Jim and Steve and I met a couple of times to talk about what was next. A few names were mentioned as possible replacements, but nothing ever went anywhere. Some of it was certainly exhaustion and shell shock, but there was something else, too. We never talked about it, but I could see it in all of us, in the way we'd sometimes let a conversation just fizzle, how we'd keep finding excuses to put things off, how all of us seemed to be looking around more often, staring out windows and standing in open doors. There was a silent, persistent something that was always there in the room with us. At first, I thought it was simply that we missed Andy, and that the hole he left in our lives was too noticeable for us to get past. Now, I think that we were all just waiting. Jim's suicide caught me by surprise. I hadn't talked to him in a couple of years when I got the call from Steve. Gunshot to the head. No note. I didn't go to the service. I was in a pretty rough patch when I got the news, low on money, but still scratching enough together to keep drinking. Every minor inconvenience had served as mounting evidence of the world's continued mission to target me, personally. And now, here was something truly depressing. I turned the booze intake up to 11 and didn't start easing off for another 6 months. It was during that time that I lost my previous apartment and ended up in this delightful little rat hole. Jim was in my thoughts a lot during that period, in spite of my best efforts. Time and again, I found myself thinking of his nose bleeding at that last show, of him tapping his foot in the van, of him freaking out over that coffee cup in the IHOP. The image that kept coming back to me was of him looking at his fingers in surprise, or betrayal. In some sense, it was obvious, of course, even with how crazy it seemed. But I kept drowning that next logical thought in alcohol, keeping it asleep. Trying to keep a lot of things asleep. They had started shortly after the breakup, creeping up on my periphery, hardly noticeable. I'd be on the bus, hungover or still outright drunk, mind drifting from nothing to nothing, and I'd suddenly come back to myself and look around. Something had just happened. Someone had coughed or shuffled their feet, and it had grabbed me. Or I'd be at home, switching through channels on the TV, and the aleatoric mishmash of audio would line up in a certain way that caught my ear. The passing of cars on the street below my apartment, the electrical chittering of an overhead fluorescent at the unemployment office, the pattering of rain against my window. Now that I know it's there, I keep hearing it everywhere. Sometimes it's even real. That same obscured and shifting rhythm, sometimes from a single source, sometimes from the seemingly coincidental input of several things. It pervades everything, even when it's not directly audible. An amorphous, lumbering thing, moving beneath the skin of the world. Back then, when I first started to notice it, I thought it was the booze. Or that I was simply starting to lose my grip on things. Later, after I cleaned up a bit, I figured it was just my overly idle brain creating a mystery for itself to pass the time, or maybe even some weird repressed guilt over the band that was trying to find a way to express itself. But now, there's no doubt. I haven't had a drink in over a year, and it's still happening. More damning than that, I've seen other people notice it. I'll be in line at the store, and the beeping of the item scanner will suddenly hit a certain pattern, and I'll look up, startled both at this newest manifestation of the rhythm, and also because the person in front of me jumped at the same time. A construction worker at an unseen build site will be hammering away, a power saw will start up, overlaying it and creating that same rhythm, and the bag lady next to me at the bus stop will pause in her mumbled ranting, jaw quivering, and then start to sob. I remember that one in particular, because my first thought at seeing her break down was, "That unworthy bitch." It had come to me from nowhere. But more than anything else, I know it's real because Andy told me it was. He told me from his hospital bed. The Miriam Hospital is in North Providence, tucked among a residential area. I got there in the late afternoon 3 days ago. The flight cost more than I could afford, but as soon as Steve called and told me what happened, I knew I had to go. Steve refused to join me. Andy had actually been there for a while, though none of us knew how long. Gotta love the music community. A newly hired janitor was a friend of a friend of a friend of Steve's, and the information eventually got back to him. HIPAA be damned. Andy was in a coma. Stable, but non-responsive. There was no information about what he had been doing before or how he ended up back in Providence. The lady at the front desk gave me his room number, making some comment about how popular he was that day. I didn't ask, and she didn't elaborate. I walked through the nearly deserted hospital, listening to my shoes squeaking on the tiled floor, listening for patterns. Andy was lying in a bed near a large window on the third floor, the orange light of the setting sun giving his skin the illusion of health. Over the next few hours, I would see how pale he had truly become, how thin and cadaverous. There were several machines hooked up to him, beeping and churring as they performed the magic that maintained his body's tenuous survival in his absence. His eyes were closed, and if not for the slow rise and fall of his chest in response to the ventilator, I would have sworn that he was already dead. I sat there for a long time, slouched in a plastic chair near the door, watching him. I thought back to all of the good times we had, in college, on the road, just hanging out. I thought of Andy's eternal quest for inspiration, his seemingly insatiable need to hone his art, how he always wanted to be in a group, to connect with people, to communicate and be truly understood. I thought of the look he gave me from the stage that night, confusion and disappointment replacing near religious ecstasy. As evening turned to night, I started to sense it again, that languid, arrhythmic throb, and I realized that it had been there the whole time, not just while I was in the room or the hospital, but from the moment I landed at PVD and disembarked the plane. I couldn't hear it, but it was there. A slight throb behind my eyes, a rippling in the window drapes swaying in the forced air, a stuttering hesitancy in the shadows as they passed across the wall. It was full dark out now, and I could see a brilliant spray of stars in the night sky. I stood and walked over to the window, and as I did so, the pressure behind my eyes intensified. It was something I could almost hear now. That disjointed tensing and releasing of some universal fiber. Andy's bed was right next to me now, and I reached down, blindly taking his limp hand as I stared out the window. The swelling increased more aggressively, and yes, I could hear it now, in the hum of the air conditioning, the droning of the life support machines rising and falling, starting to resolve itself into individual sounds, individual voices. My vision began to close in as those slithering tongues whispered incomprehensible madness to me through the keyhole of the universe. The night sky darkened further, and the stars seemed to grow more pronounced. They began to throb in time with the strange rhythm, becoming brighter and brighter with each pulse. I was no longer holding Andy's hand. He was holding mine, gripping it with distant but distinct strength. That rhythm was in Andy, too, in the beating of his heart, in the way the clammy flesh of his palm seemed to almost skitter across mine, in the subconscious electrical waves seeping from his dead brain. I couldn't pull my eyes from the stars, now so luminous that they were almost blinding. Still, they kept ratcheting up in intensity, and I suddenly realized that one was outshining the rest, blazing a pinhole of nothingness into my vision that grew and grew until it enveloped me. The stars vanished, the hospital room vanished, Andy vanished, I vanished. I was null, no form, no thought, no soul. I was less than nothing, a mote of effervescence in the eternal black. I had no frame of reference, no body, no eyes, but the titanic vastness of that endless chasm crushed down on me. This was a place beyond all light, beyond all life, a vacuous void that dwarfed even the universal finality of death. And as I floated there, nothing but a wisp of a memory of consciousness, I felt it. Within that colossal and unending darkness, something shifted. A form of deeper, more substantial black subtly distinguished itself against the backdrop of that monumental abyss, and it moved, hefting its wretched and gargantuan corpus by the smallest of degrees. The surrounding shadow rippled, cascading outward into infinity, the unseen ridges colliding with themselves across dimensions both near and far. And as they did, they reflected back to me in that same inescapable pattern. I was nothing, abandoned to the furthest reaches of the outer darkness. But back in the hospital room, I was screaming, Andy's comatose body beside me. It's time to stop writing. I'm hearing it again, in the rain, in the scratching of my pen, even in my own breathing. I'm beginning to have thoughts that aren't strictly my own. I've put down everything that I intended to, and I'm now finding myself asking what the point was. There's no conclusion, not even a sense of catharsis. Andy always wanted to belong, to communicate, to be understood. For the longest time, music was his language, and he used that to touch the lives of those that heard him play. But eventually, he found something that couldn't be expressed by music, as hard as he tried. It was his new gospel, and he needed to spread it. He did find a way to convey this final message, but he had to go deep. Had to sacrifice everything to be able to say it. Andy got a glimpse behind the curtain. Now, he wants to pull it back for the rest of us to see. I've spent the last few days contemplating all of this. I don't know what's coming or when, but it frightens me. I think of that Leviathan shape in the endless night, its most insignificant movement disrupting the dream that we all cling to. I could go back to Providence to visit Andy one final time, to turn off the transmitter that's broadcasting this subconscious alien signal. But I've seen how profoundly this slight amplification has already cracked the shell of our reality, and I've seen the tendrils of the other seeping in from beyond. Yes, I could go back, and it might even be a mercy to end Andy's continued quest for connection, but I ask myself if it would even be worth it. The beast is already waking. You've been listening to Cadenza by Eric Peabody. Eric Peabody is a voice actor and audio engineer in Rochester, New York. He has written several stories that have been featured on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights podcast, including Hospitality, Snow Day, and October 14th. He has also contributed music and audio work to games such as Valorant, Clash Royale, Marvel Superhero Squad Online, Star Wars The Old Republic, and Wreck-It Ralph, Ralph Breaks VR. In addition to hosting Horror Hill and mixing podcasts and metal albums, he runs a video game music thrash band under the Viking Guitar moniker. He and his fiancée live in a house festooned with Castlevania accoutrements, along with their sweet and stupid cat, James Banana. Dear listeners, thank you for bearing with me and tolerating my narcissistic ramblings. Sometimes you just need to write about heavy music and the elder gods, right? If you particularly liked or disliked this story, please let me know. I'm not averse to contributing more material in the future, but at the same time, don't want to hold you all hostage to my ego if this is something that you don't enjoy. Besides, I probably already have enough hostages to take care of down in the cellar. Thank you all for joining me tonight. Your enthusiasm and support is what keeps this show going, and I appreciate it. I'll be back next week with a double feature comprised of stories by Horror Hill mainstays Sam Morris and A.W. Mason. Be sure to tune in then, and in the meantime, keep the world metal and stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted and narrated by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Original music provided by Eric Peabody and Nikki McSorley. Finalization by Eric Peabody and Craig Groshek. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at natalie@chillingtalesfordarknights.com to have your work considered for future production. Seeing as how we're all living in a technological nightmare of our own devising, I'll ask you to follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. Not only will you have appeased the dark gods of cyberspace, but you'll be kept in the loop as we prepare more terrifying content. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend becoming a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Otis Gyre's Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, Paul J. McSorley's Fear from the Heartland, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. As for me personally, I'm on most social media as Viking Guitar or Viking Guitar Productions. I'm always on the lookout for new stories to narrate and new music projects to mix or master. If that's of interest to you, feel free to reach out and we can talk turkey. Also, I will be back next week with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps.
In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic.
Keep your eyes on the road.
Hop on Moto Casino.
Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly.
Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.